notification system takes them upward. It's a step system, so that the bottom step and the top step are different.
That's right, there'd be some saving.
Mr. Chairman, I think, however, that you would find in looking at the bottom step and the top step of state employee salaries, non-teacher, that the composition of the employees in that steps, in those steps would remain the same. Somebody in the top step leaves, they're usually not replaced with somebody in a bottom step. They're usually replaced with somebody that comes up from the fifth step, and then you go on. And so you end up having a composition of employees that looks pretty much like it was previously. And if it's in a higher level salary in executive service or high-level management service, then most often those people are hired in at the top step anyway. So I don't think that whereas it might be clear in the teaching field, I think in the state employees field, that would not be the case.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. I guess I want to follow that up a little. We talked about what the savings would be to the, you know, to teachers, to that particular profession. What, has anyone played with the figures about how many people overall might fit into this category that had 30 years but were still, you know, what, under 55, and what kind of impact that would have and how it fits in?
Yes, the actuary does have the numbers of the people that would qualify for that. And his numbers that he has selected to drive the cost is a percentage of those people that would actually select that option. So, yes, that information is available. He would be able to provide that.
So we're just going to have to wait till we hear from the actuary.
I think the actuary has indicated his figures are based on 20% of the people.
20% of the people that are eligible.
Opting to do that.
And have we gotten an increase in the employer's rate based on that projection?
Yes.
How much would that be?
That's in House Bill 2849. The rate projected and rate increase is 0.08% for state agencies.
0.08 for state.
0.10% for local government entities, and 0.9% for school districts. And then looking at the state agency fiscal general fund fiscal impact, that would be approximately $650,000 in 1989-91 general fund, and that's of a total $1.8 million cost. The remaining, of course, would be other funds and federal funds.
Now, in these figures, is there some attempt to figure out whether or not there would be the savings based on who gets replaced with whom?
Right.
Or is that ignored in the total amount
I believe
of
that the actuary, and he isn't here, it's I think the actuary would simply ignored. Take the salary and take the actuarial tables that he's working with now and assume that 20% of the eligible people would opt, and of course the actuary would be working with averages.
But the actuary would not be able to determine what the replacement cost would be.
The 640 is the actual cost to the system and does not take in consideration
what
any reduction
savings
may occur because a professor was hired with less experience.
You'd have to track it in order to really come back with some hard figures.
It'd be impossible to say.
However, there is also a distinct advantage, and that is to keep some of our talent that we're graduating in the state systems and in our high schools within the state of Oregon, which we have been losing outside. The other thing I was interested.
Would you repeat that?
We were losing a lot of our graduates outside the state to jobs because there isn't the opportunities within the state available in
for
many
teaching
places.
Jobs.
So
teaching
would you get
jobs.
These old duffers out of the
That's
way?
Right.
Is that the idea?
That's right.
Any old duffers you know?
Any old duffers.
You want me not to run for re-election?
The other thing I was interested in, which is not in the bill, and something vaguely reminds me of something that occurred in the state of New York, where somebody could retire within the state. They were garbage collectors or in the fire area. They could retire early and turn around and get another job and get a double retirement. And I wonder if you want to look at that bill from precluding that kind of a thing of coming back into the system under a double dip type of situation.
I don't think they would be eligible at the current time to come come back into the system and work.
Well, if I'm 50 years old and retire, why couldn't I?
You couldn't in PERS.
You could go into the military for another 20 years.
I think we had a problem a few years ago where we sought legislation to allow legislators to be able to retire and come back, or excuse me, people retire and come back into the legislature. We had a Representative McCray who resigned from the legislature because he was ineligible for his PRS benefits, which he needed. And so he resigned from the legislature. I think we passed legislation so that you could retire from PRS and still be a legislator.
We certainly did.
Yes. I don't know of anybody like that.
We have a 600-hour limit. I don't remember who all applied to. I know that Representative McCray resigned from the legislature and did not run because of that. So that has already been.
That has been taken care of.
Been taken care of.
The statute also includes a 600-hour limit for PERS participating retirees. So if you come back to work for another PERS participating employer.
You're limited to 600. I knew that held an academic. I didn't know if it held throughout the entire system.
I think that was in part in order for the legislature to hire retired police officers to serve as security officers in the legislature.
Well, are you saying that if somebody is 30 and out and retires from this system and then wants to run for the legislature, you can't get in and get your PERS benefits?
Well, you can get your PERS benefits now, but prior to legislation, you weren't able to. That's correct.
I was wondering about somebody who is 30 and out and then still, you know, is 55 and runs for the legislature.
Well, they will be able to receive their PERS benefits and serve in the legislature.
I know, but can they build any more? Are they in PERS then, and do they, what happens to them?
I don't think so.
I can't answer that.
I don't think it matters.
I can't answer the question.
It's not that important.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Van.
That's what I was looking for.
Did he leave?
No, he's right here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's ready to test.
Oh, he already joined the paddle here. I'm just sitting up in front here.
He's just bringing me the good statistics.
I guess we've sort of ranged here on a number of bills. Which one of these four bills do you want to comment on?
In the remaining 3 minutes that the committee has,
we're going to take another half hour. The committee seems to be amenable to it. Once we're stuck here, we're slightly fixed. And obviously,
no four sessions, and you might just go on.
The reason we started out today as precipitously as we did, I thought that if the committee was going to have the PRS bills, we better get started on as soon as possible. And I think the testimony today has indicated that that was
wise.
So we'll try to have as many more hours as we can, interrupted by calls of the senator, calls of the house.
For the record, I'm Bob Van Hout, President of the United Seniors, and I'm in a different category in that I'm speaking really for retirees at this time, and I have no quarrel with those who are speaking for active employees, and I have no quarrel with the 30-year and out. I have an observation for Mr. Van Fleet's comments about what happened in New York, and this is not uncommon because in a number of states...
Give us the context. What happened in New York? What are you talking
about? Well, where the person had worked as a teacher and then went to work as a garbage man and got a double dinner situation.
Okay.
It happens because in some states they have dual or triple or multiple retirement systems. They have a retirement system for teachers, they have a retirement system for their other public employees, they have another retirement system for firefighters and fire and policemen, with the result that you can go from one public retirement system to another and get benefits if you have added years in that second system. In Oregon, of course, with the single type of public retirement system, the opportunity to switch back and forth is not there. So I did want to, you wondered why it happened, but that's what happened.
Plus the federal military.
Oh, yes, you have all of those, yeah.
I'd be curious to know whether that teacher who went to garbage man got a salary increase when he made this
one. Oh, no question that he did.
I think it was the other way around. I think he went from garbage man to teacher.
Oh, he did. Okay. Whatever.
It probably would be no surprise to you to know that we are supportive of Senate Bill 573.
You need to add any, I think we're all aware of the tremendous importance of it. To the recipients, do you want to add anything more to the questions about the feasibility?
Obviously, if we're going to have significant savings by having older teachers and older professors replaced by younger teachers.
No, we're talking about 573.
No, I know, but I mean, if you get all that savings, then maybe you'll have enough savings on payroll taxes to pay for the difference of what you need to take care of the,
right,
of the funding under 573. I have a couple of observations, and I would like to reserve the opportunity to come back when we have
sure,
more time,
you will,
because I don't want to belabor the committee. I think two or three elements which need to be considered. We've talked a lot about unfunded liability, and you had the fact that we are in this state in the amazingly unique situation of having only 7% of unfunded liability. A tremendously unique situation. In the great bulk of the states, when they get to the point of where they have only 40% unfunded liability, they think they're on top of the world. Because obviously, as you have people coming in who are going to be contributing to the system, and as you have new earnings coming in, you're always going to have unfunded liability. Anytime you hire somebody, you have unfunded liability, because you say, we're going to pay a person a retirement benefit when they retire, we don't have the money now, we're going to collect the money over a period of time. So it's a very unique, a very fortunate situation, but I think it might distort our thinking, because we always want to be pure, we want to get to 100%, and we have even precluded that by saying we're going to extend the payments over a period of time.
Bob, we don't have
time.
92% funded now, do we?
Yeah.
What we do have is what?
92.
Yeah.
Now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to, we're shooting for 100 in 30 years.
Right, I need to meet with a constituent for 10 minutes.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
No. That's what Let me, I just missed a couple points. Of the number of retirees that we have in the system, we have about almost 53,000 retirees. 5,000 of these retirees retired prior to 1970. You have a small group, 5,000 retirees who have retired prior to 1970. I'd like to point out their average monthly benefit as of 1988. The average benefit for that group of retirees runs from $177 a month all the way up to $258 a month. They're living in Fat City, as you obviously can see. Some of those people are obviously far behind when it comes to relative purchasing power compared to what they were getting when they retired. Even at the current adjusted figure of $258 a month, that includes all the adjustments that have been made for cost of living
if
since
we
they have retired.
Most of them would get Social Security in addition.
They would get Social Security in addition. But it would be comparable to this amount.
Right. Wouldn't be very much.
Yeah, it wouldn't be much because on a lower salary at that time.
Right.
And so our plea is, if we are going to do any kind of adjustment in what we have talked about in 573, that we give consideration to those people who are at the bottom of the scale and who are bleeding from every pore. And remember, the person who retired in 1968 is no longer 65. That person is 85. And if you say, well, we'll postpone any payments to them until 1995, you might as well forget it.
Well, they keep living longer.
Well, they have to, but I mean, it's because they have strong endurance, I guess.
Yeah, they want to live longer to get their checks.
Yeah, they're waiting for their checks. So I want to call that to your attention.
It's a kind of a cruel way to reduce the cost of the bill.
We feel strongly about that, sir, and I'm sure it'd be no surprise to you to know that we are dismayed by the fact that we have some people who are 31% behind with their salary compared to what the purchasing power should put them at. Some of them retired at the wrong time. They retired just before inflation on a low salary. They got caught during the 70s when the trap of high inflation killed them off. The cost of living increases did not keep up. And we have one group, for instance, that retired in 1974. Their purchasing power is 31% behind what it would have been if we had maintained purchasing power during this whole time. The bill that we initially proposed showed lack of courage on our part. We proposed initially a bill which would do this over about 4 years, so that we would give these people, let me say, 7 or 8% per year for 4 years, rather than trying to do it in all one fell swoop as the current bill now does. The current bill would get all of these people up to par. They would get varying rates of increases depending on where they are, and it's all been determined by the actuary, and I have these figures, which I'll make available to you, showing where they are in the year where they retired in comparison to what their purchasing power was in 1988, you see. So the Labor Committee talked about our bill initially. They then said, no, let's change it. Let's clean the slate. Let's get everybody up to snuff. And then in 91, if we have to make increases, everybody would get the same kind of increase because we'd have everybody on an even keel. That was the thinking behind this. And that was the reason that we came.
But when you talk about even keel, you're just talking about returning your buying power to what it was when you retired at 100%, and if you had the low salary, you're not going to get as much as the person that had the high salaries.
The dollar amounts will not be the same, of course, because the dollar amounts were based upon what you were, where you were, and where you were going to be. So that if you were getting $177 a month, so you're going to get maybe 20% more, so you're going to get $34 a month more. But if it was $800 a month, you'd get obviously a significant amount if the same rate were applied. So the rate is adjusted to where those people are.
It sounds really tremendously good, and it is, but it's not going to do a lot as much for these people who, the 5,000 before 1970, it's not going to increase their amounts dramatically.
No, and I don't want to elaborate. There are a lot of things we could talk about, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have, but we do want to come with some more information, some more data for you, so you can look at this.
Right.
We recognize the impact of 0.2%, 0.1% on payroll. I could give you a long harangue about the assumed rate. Here again, 92% of full funding is not enough. It needs to be 100%, so we keep it at 7.5. And I'm not sure that that is philosophically or economically sound, because some of those who are currently employed and who are going to be employed after us have an obligation to meet some of that expense rather than having it all paid for them the day they start employment.
I think that there's another point that hasn't been mentioned, and I would hope eventually it would be detailed. It seems to me that the one aspect of this is that the retirees ought to be able to benefit by the effect of inflation upon the interest rate. Their payments are based upon an assumption rate which is long since obsolete.
Ought
to have their payments reflect more nearly current assumption rates, without it seeming at all that you're causing the present system to have to pay for things that weren't wouldn't have been actuarially sound on the basis of the rates that they paid, but they may very, very well be actuarially sound, reflecting the present assumption rates on interest.
And Mr. Chairman,
I think that ought to be explored. It hasn't been mentioned, I don't think, here.
I thought maybe it was a given, but actually, when I talk to our retirees statewide, they will always say, look at how much money the system is making. Why can't they take care of us? They've got money in every pocket, and yet they don't want to give us a cost of living increase when we're bleeding from every pore. And we hear that so much that I thought you had too, you see.
Yes. That money that's coming in is reflecting current conditions, and the cost of the much higher payments that present or recent retirees are getting and so forth. But I think if you talk about the interest rates are inflated, why not have that reflected in the benefits to the retirees?
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. I do not want to belabor the committee. But
okay.
And I appreciate the
Bob,
chance.
Thank you very much, and we will hear you back again.
Thank you again.
We'll try to accumulate and contact various witnesses about the data that we'd like to have presented to us.
I could ask that the actuary be able to respond to your comment.
Yes, would please. Cecil? Cecil Posey.
Chairman,
Representative Peterson had to leave for about 10 minutes. She'll be back. She had some testimony she had to give. She'll be back.
I had
some
material to pass out. Mr. Chairman, I'm legislative chairman of the Oregon Retired Educators Association and have been for a number of years.
This is the group that requested the bill that we have in front of us, right?
Yeah, I have introduced, initiated a bill every year since 1977 for retirees on the name of the OREA. And everyone has been successful except 83 and 87. We've had increases. And as you look at the retirees, I have a chart here on the last page, Exhibit B. On the right-hand column, you'll notice here that the group that is not up to date as far as the CPI is concerned is 72 through about 75, and there's 78 and 79. And that is the group, of course, that Senator Hill, when this 573 was before the Senate, he saw this column and saw those people so far out of date, he immediately and incisively saw the need to bring everybody up to date. And it was his amendment, of course, which the committee adopted, which does bring this up to date. And you can see on this sheet here how far those people are behind and where they are. Now, luckily, those from 84 on through, they're pretty good. They're very little behind. And actually, our bill that we introduced originally was a bill, a formula we'd used since 81, known as the Christensen Bill. A professor at Oregon State developed that, and we've been using
Bert
it. And,
yeah.
And Bert over there had developed it, and I've been using it for, I guess, 81, 83, 85, 87. And you know, I haven't got it yet in there. And I think that Senator Hill's approach is much better than my approach, or the approach we had to begin with. And I appreciate what he did to bring this up.
But it did add to the cost of the bill.
Well, that a little bit to cost, yeah, probably a couple of million. 6.5 and about 4.5, I believe, without that. But it is equity and does bring everyone up to where they should be.
Absolutely.
So that is what I would like to support. And I haven't talked to the executive committee or anybody else around here. And I don't know about cutting this thing in half. I'm supporting the full amount which came over from the Senate. Now, I don't know whether I lobby somebody else around here or not, but I haven't talked to them. And I'm not in favor of cutting down this, the figures that we have given. And on, I will say this, we've talked about the earnings. I want to say that Senator Ward Cook, I worked with him two sessions, 61-3 and 63 session. And finally, we got the method of investing the funds changed from long-term bonds, 5%, to where the PERS board at that time, and later the investment council, could invest funds otherwise. It took us two sessions to get that passed. That was 63 session. And so I worked for this all the time. And I might say that I had bills in legislature to help retirees in the 50s. Those are the people who had 20 years service, $4 a month. And so I had bills in then. About the...
With reference to your lobbying, maybe we should have applied the 30-year and out.
Now I take 40 to identify, that's about 40 years.
That should always be optional, and good people should be allowed to continue.
The return, I want to talk about 7.5% return. As you see on the chart that I present on Exhibit A, you can see what the earnings have been year after year due to the investment policies of the investment council. Now, 7.5% is needed to make the system actuarially sound according to the board at the present time. That's what they estimate or they hope to get. Well, all above that are excess earnings. It's excess money. And as far as the retirees are concerned, I am concerned, that is excess earnings off of the money put in by the employees and compensation paid for by employers. It's not employers' money. It is money earned as a part of the salary of an employee. It's a part of the package, the contract, what they get. So it's not employers' money. It's really employees' money put in there on behalf of by the employer on behalf of the employee. So the entire $8.5 billion, as far as I'm concerned, is money put in there by employees or on their behalf for compensation the other part the employer puts in. And we do have excess earnings.
That's an assumption that you can make, I think, from your point of view, but I think the employers would explain it differently.
Well, they might. But nevertheless, when you go to work, you accept that benefit package at your compensation.
Yeah.
Like sick leave, like health insurance, or anything else, retirement is a part of it, of the compensation which the worker gains. And it's his money when it's once put in there by the employer. Now then, the excess over that, in the years that it exceeds 7.5%, that money either goes to reduce the employer's contribution or it goes into reserves, the excess over that. So for that reason, we argue that should be used to help bring the CPI up to date. That those excess earnings should be used to bring the CPI up to date. I hope that everyone understands that. We often have people, because it's going to cost the system so much, that actually what they're talking about is assumed cost. Assumed cost. But if the interest is more than 7.5%, those costs are lowered because of those excess earnings. And a lot of people don't understand that, but that's actually what happened. They're only counting on 7.5%. But it's 15%, you have excess earnings which go to reduce employers' cost, or put in reserves. It usually goes to reduce costs because reserves only built up so high. So I think that's primarily
the question is whether the excess earnings then go to reduce the cost to the employers or go to improve the benefits from to the employees who've retired, the retirees. And it's more often than not, most of the benefits go into the employers.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
And that's these arguments I've used for years, and I've used it consistently. In the early part of the 60s, up to 61 or 2, I had bills in helping ad hoc increases. The PERS board began to give, whenever they had excess earnings, more than they needed, they gave an extra check. And during some of those years, they gave 2, 3, and 4 checks extra, recognizing that those investments earnings belong to the retirees. They did that. Well, in 72, they changed that to where employees are entitled to 2% cost of living if the CPI reaches 2%. If the CPI isn't 2%, they don't get 2%. Some people say it's automatic. It's not automatic. They get it if it gets to be 2%. Then over 2%, what was said was indicated in the law at that time, if they only get 2% and the cost of living is 6%, they get 4% put in the bank. So when the 2%, the cost of living is less than 2%, they can draw on the bank to bring it up to 2%. That's what I'm saying? Yeah. They got credit for that excess, but in years if they didn't get 2%, they could draw out of that to bring it up 2%. And that's still the law. I checked that with PR
the
other day.
Still the law?
Yeah, I checked with...
When did they start the practice of using it to reduce the employer's benefits?
Yeah. During what?
When did they start using that the earnings then to reduce the rate to the employer rather than putting it in the bank?
That was in about, I guess it was about 72, when they quit giving. Before that, I don't know now. They gave extra monthly checks. Mm-hmm. They get 12 checks. At the end of that period, they get 4 more checks because there were excess earnings in the fund. Now, that's in the study by Miller Roberts. You have that study. I hope that you have that. Or I have copies here, which I'll give to you. I thought they'd provide you with it.
I don't believe so. I haven't got that yet.
Interesting,
anyway.
Interesting history. I didn't know that.
Well, I have that.
Okay. Well, we'll get it.
I have that Miller Roberts study.
Yeah, we won't. You'll
maybe
give it to
take
us.
Time to get into it.
Why don't you just let the staff have it here, and we'll get it distributed to the members.
And the whole history of that ad hoc increases over in that study. And they began, I think it's 71 session of the legislature adopted, rather than the addition salary, the checks, or retirement checks, they adopted a 2% formula. And that's what we're still living with today. In a way, I look at that as a protection for the employers. Because it's 2%. And then I'll say we have to come back every session legislature and convince the legislature to bring it up. In a way, that's protection. The 2% is protection. You see what I mean? That protects it. Then we have to come back and make a convincing case to you to give an ad hoc to keep people up with CPI. Now, one or two states do give a CPI every year in the retirement program. Others have 3%, but most of them are 2 or less, if you look at it. I think that's all I have to say. We are supporting the amendment which Senator Hill and the committee brought to you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to know and hear from PERS, how do they use the earnings? Do the earnings go back into the reserve fund? Or do they go to the employers? Do they go to meet the current obligations? What happens with the earnings, the interest earnings from the reserves?